Hi, my name's Neil Cameron, and I make comics. But I'm not here to talk about that, I'm here to talk about a comic that I read. The comic is called Lost Tales, it's by Adam Murphy. It appeared in The Phoenix, the weekly story comic for children, and it is, quite simply, extraordinary. It's a fascinating work by a fascinating creator, and immediately upon finishing reading it, I had about 1,000 questions I wanted the answers to about it. Fortunately for me, I know Adam, and he agreed to let me ask him these questions. So what follows is an interview with Adam Murphy, principally on the subject of his strip Lost Tales, but taking in also his wonderful weekly historical strip Corpse Talk, and his upcoming self-published and categorically not for children comic, Fever Dreams. Along the way, we take in folklore, art, beheadings and the best way to present them in a child-appropriate manner, and the practicalities of making a living as a comics creator. I found it fascinating talking to Adam, and I hope you enjoy it as well. Here's the interview. Should we dive in, do you think?
Yes, let's.
Okay, well, so the reason I wanted to do this was just because I like your comics so much.
Well, thank you.
And specifically about this new series, or these new strips you've been doing, called Lost Tales.
Yes.
Which I just was completely blown away by and found fascinating and wanted to ask you 1,000 questions about.
Sure, well,
so I
thank
thought,
you.
I thought that might remotely be interesting to someone else as well. So,
cool.
We could record
well,
it.
Let's hope so.
So, first of all, I guess just in case anyone hasn't read these strips or isn't familiar with them, if you could just sort of quickly just set up what Lost Tales is, what it's about.
Sure. Lost Tales is a series of short comics in the Phoenix. They are basically unusual or unknown fairy tales or folk tales from around the world. And it's a combination of ones that maybe people don't know or don't know as well. And then there's also some which are familiar stories, but from unfamiliar settings. So the first one that we did was called Strong Wind
and Little Scabs.
Little Scabs, yes. Which is basically the Cinderella story.
Yeah, exactly.
But it's a version that comes from the Mi'kmaq Algonquin Indians in sort of the Atlantic Northeast of America. America, you know, USA and Canada, what is now. And the story was recorded, I guess, in the 19th century, so there'd already been quite a lot of contact. So it's possible that it was a version which had been, you know, Indians had heard Cinderella version and then had, you know, had adapted it and mixed it with traditional motifs or traditional ideas.
Yeah.
Or it may be an example. There are some tales which are just so old that they are actually found throughout the world, and suggest a very, very early origin, which has then, you know, been passed down and passed around.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, it could be either way, but that one is very interesting because, though it has the basic Cinderella motifs are there. There's two.
You've got the mean old sisters.
Mean older sisters who take advantage of the younger sister, make her do all sorts of
horrors. Cruelly put upon younger sisters.
Exactly, exactly. And there's a wonderful potential bridegroom who everybody wants to marry and nobody can.
Yeah.
And in this case, it's because he's invisible. This wonderful warrior and hunter who's a superb potential husband. But he's invisible.
Got the best tent, got the best TV.
Exactly, exactly. But because he's invisible, the test is to see if any potential bride can see him. And the one who can see him will be the one that he marries. So this is the test that gets set up. And everybody goes to try, including the evil sisters. And of course, they fail. And then one day, Little Scabs, who's so-called because...
And the point is that they all pretend they can see him.
Exactly, exactly.
They all lie and claim that they can see his belt and his bow. But they are all liars. And the person who's giving this test can tell immediately that
right,
they're lying.
Right, exactly.
By their
exactly.
answers. Yes.
So, and then... So Little Scabs is so-called because she gets pushed in the fire by her evil sisters, all her hair has been burnt off, her face is all burnt up and so
she
on.
She is very cruelly put upon.
She really is. It's pretty vicious. So she decides to go and try it, and everybody laughs at her, but she's determined to do it anyway. And that's kind of as much as I can say without spoiling the ending.
Yes, I don't want to give away the ending to the story.
Well, I mean...
I want to talk around the ending.
Sure.
But we don't want to say what it is exactly for anyone who's not familiar with the story already.
Mm. But it's tricky because the reason why I wanted to do that one particularly is because it moves from being a fairly standard Cinderella-type story into being something actually really quite moving and profound about... relationship with, I don't know, with nature or with God or with the universe in some way, that I think is inherent in these fairy stories always. And the bride or the bridegroom often symbolizes this sort of stuff.
Yeah.
But it's kind of deep under and it's covered with these different layers. Whereas in this one, it's just very raw and it's very apparent what it's really about. And I thought that really made it special.
I'll get the adulation out of the way early here. I was going to build up to this, but that story and the reveal, the ending of that story, really did, you know, it hit me and it struck me in a way that very few comics have, and it's just one of the best comics I've read in a very long time. And
thank you. That's great to hear, because my big concern with this stuff always is I've feeling these things, and I'm hoping it's coming across, but I don't know if it's, you know, our audience is going to get that. So at least you got it.
Well,
I'm sure that some.
I know I'm not exactly the target audience. For our comics, but
my hope is that
there's. I think you communicated it so clearly, and because it felt like a very familiar story. You know, it has all. Maybe it's the Cinderella sort of. Aspects to it, but it had all that power of myth, but hit you new in the way that these stories are often very familiar and so sort of already known, so you can try and do interesting new things with them, but everyone knows the basic underlying story. This one just absolutely, partly the way you told it, or partly I wasn't familiar with the source material, it really, you know, hit me like a fairy tale is supposed to hit its audience, and that happens so rarely, I think. I thought it was absolutely remarkable, particularly the reveal, the ending, which we're not going to talk about, which literally took my breath away. I gasped for air when I saw that, and tears came to my eyes, and I struggled for breath. So I told you I was going to be quite... there was going to be some adulation.
Well, thank you. But that's my great hope is that there's some kids out there who'll have that. And for whom it will be that special thing that helps them make sense of life in the way that those special stories, when I was growing up, you know, helped me to make sense of life.
Absolutely. I'm sure they will. I'm quite sure they will. In terms of sort of where doing these came from, just to bring it down to some mundane sort of questions.
Let's.
Were these... Did you have the idea to do this sort of as a series, or was that one particular story that you wanted to tell? And then you thought, oh, we could do some more of these.
No, it was a series, and it was actually a different one. The one I'm working on now, which hasn't been published yet, I'm still inking it, was actually the first one that I thought of. I think the idea was to do a series of unusual fairy tales, which has been kind of vaguely in my mind for a long time. I mean, do you remember the... Remember Jim Henson's The Storyteller?
Yeah, absolutely.
Basically, ever since I saw that, which was age, 13 or 14, the vague idea of that was amazing. And I want more of that, and nobody else is doing it, so it's going to have to be me. I think that's been kind of vaguely in my head for a long, long time.
But
it's only now that... I think the combination of my skill is now at the point where I can do justice to the stories, and I've got enough things that I want to say that I can pull out of the stories, I think, you know, without forcing things onto them, but finding stories that hopefully have a bit of that in them. And also, I mean, honestly, a part of it was just I knew that, you know, I'm sort of, as listeners may or may not know, I do a weekly strip for the Phoenix called Corpse Talk, which is about the life of famous people from history, but they're all dead people.
I'll rant about how great Corpse Talk is in the introduction. Don't worry.
And that's a wonderful strip to be doing, and I really love doing it. It takes quite a lot of time. So
yes,
purely from a mundane, how can I make this work point of view, I was thinking about what would be, because I've done a few one-off stories for the Phoenix, which are vaguely fairy tale-ish, but that I made up. And those tended to take quite a while. So I was thinking, if I was using existing source material, that would
that'd be
quicker.
Easier, right?
Not easier, but quicker. And genuinely, from a purely, how can I be a professional comics artist and actually get paid enough to live on? That is a big factor.
Which is always a question.
It's always a question, right? So that was part of the thinking, but also, how can I do something that is not just a hack job, but has something important and meaningful and precious in it as well?
And those two
things coming together was kind of where this started from. I started digging around, looking for, you know, unusual fairy, and also sources. Where can I find, you know, trawling through the Aaron Thompson list of fairy tales and so on to find stuff? Where are going to be good places where I can go to find folk tales that have this sort of stuff in them?
That was going to be something I want to ask you, whether these were stories you were familiar with of old, or if you've been sort of...
It's a mixture.
Doing a lot of research lately, because they're quite... Strong Wind and Little Scabs feels very familiar, but the one that's just appeared, The Grateful Dead Guy, and that's just a cracking story that I had never heard in my life before. I don't know where you found that one.
That one's a new one. That one I found, there's a, I would need to look it up, but there's a website, basically an academic, you know, anthropology folktale kind of guy.
Yeah.
Who has a bunch of these stories. I'm guessing they're from, I think they're from the Aaron Thompson list, which is two, I think they're Swedish folktale catalogers. A bit like the Brothers Grimm, but more scientific about it.
Okay,
and
there's
a Russian guy whose name escapes me, but it's Popov or something along those lines, who also did it. Who also did
so
something.
It sounds like a Tintin character.
Right, exactly.
Dr. Popov.
It's something like that. The two of them, between them, have produced enormous compendious lists and sort of catalogued the different types of folktale and the different variations on a theme and so on. So, so part of it is looking through a list like that and picking things out, and that's helpful because then you get different versions of the same tale. You can pick out different motifs from different places. You know, if there's this one needs a bit more juicy stuff in this particular part, and get something from somewhere else. Little Scabs one. Actually, I had known for quite a while. There's a guy called Idris Shah who's very interesting. He's primarily a Sufi thinker and author, but he's also an anthropology folktales kind of guy. And he has a book which is basically this idea of folktales which are universal or almost universal. And Little Scabs was in that. But again, with something like that, where somebody's done a retelling, I'll always try and go back and can I find the original, or at least the most old version of it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Because there's always stuff. Yeah, you know, there's being authentic, but there's always interesting stuff. If you get multiple versions, you start to pick out what are the real core emotional, meaningful story issues in this.
Yes, absolutely. I was doing just this recently, looking at several different versions of this one particular old story, and it just the differences are as illuminating as you know, the common ground.
Exactly.
So did with the Grateful, presumably you did not find this in a compendium of anthropological studies that there was a story called The Grateful Dead.
No, obviously. No, it is. It's that was what gave me the idea. The category under which these are listed was called something like The Grateful Dead or something like that.
Okay.
Now, it may be the guy's a Grateful Dead fan, and that's why he he named it that. Or it may be that the Grateful Dead got their name from this kind of stuff. I don't know. But anyway, there's a whole series of it's a recurring motif of somebody who's died but can't rest in peace or can't be buried, and, you know, all the way up to, I mean, like, The Sixth Sense had the same thing, right?
Yeah, sure.
But there's lots and lots of folk tales like this, and Mignola did one on this, did he not? There was a Hellboy story where Hellboy has to bury a dead guy in the correct grave or something.
Oh yeah, the coffin, or whatever it was, the corpse. Yeah.
So it is a recurring motif, but this particular story was just very cool and very interesting. Just
amazing.
And also, that one was, I'm always trying to find the right balance, because I have a tendency to get very kind of emotional and weepy about stuff, and I also have a tendency to do kind of rather irreverent people talking in, you know, ridiculous modern slang, and that's funny because it's it's an ancient folktale or whatever. So it's trying to find the balance of those two things, where it's, I guess.
There's something I wanted to ask you about that,
okay,
specifically, but just quickly to set it up, because we haven't really talked about the plot or the actual story of the Grateful Dead. There's a dead guy and he is grateful. Do you want to just quickly give the
Sure. So there's a it's a Russian prince who's gone to seek his fortune, and he's sailing the ocean and sees a coffin floating in the sea. Pulls it out, and right away the sailors on the ship are like, "Ooh, you can't bring that on here. It's bad luck." And he's like, no, I'm going to give this guy a proper burial, because that would be a nice thing to do. And they're like, oh, no, it's bad luck. And then immediately there's this enormous storm starts up, and they're like, see? And he's like, no, total coincidence. So they throw him overboard with the coffin. And he paddles to shore on the coffin and buries the guy and goes off to seek his fortune. But then turns around to see this corpse in the shroud with a drawn sword chasing him. And he gets all freaked out, and the guys go, it's cool, don't worry.
It's cool.
It is I, the dead guy from the coffin. So, basically, because he's so grateful for this favor the guy's done him by giving him a proper burial, he's got out of his coffin and come chasing after him to do him a favor in return. And the favor is, because the young guy's, you know, he's trying to find his fortune or whatever, and so he goes, yeah, I know what you need a wife. I know just the woman, there's this amazing queen, she's totally hot. She lives right near here. I'm going to set you up, basically. So he takes this prince over to the palace of this queen. But it turns out, so this is the cliffhanger. And we should have mentioned, all of these are in two parts. So there's the first part is the first week.
Yeah.
And then the resolution is in the second week. And I found that
is that a format you're going to be sort of sticking to?
I think I will. I find it works quite nicely because the length of a lot of folk tales is just too much to do it in one episode.
Yes,
but also there tends to be a nice cliffhanger somewhere. If I can search for it, it's usually quite a nice...
particularly in this case, do you want to just tell us the cliffhanger?
Yeah, the cliffhanger in this one is, it turns up, but the castle is surrounded by the heads of dudes that have been cut off and put on spikes.
Yes, it's an arresting image. this is something I want to ask you, then. I think this brings up a good sort of point about your approach on these.
Mm.
So that story ends on a cliffhanger of a field of heads on spikes, decapitated dead heads on spikes. It's quite gruesome. In the second part, and we won't go into too much plot spoilers for the how this story is resolved, but it does include quite a lot more scariness, some fairly hefty man-on-woman violence, culminating in a woman being beheaded.
Yeah.
And then her corpse, and then separately her head, being thrown onto a bonfire.
Yes.
And it's, you know, that you describe it in those terms, that sounds pretty bad, right?
Well, I was aware, I must admit, when I was doing this one, that there is, basically, so the queen is the one that's put all these heads on spikes, they're all of her suitors.
Yeah.
That's what happens to them, right? So he's freaking out, the dead guy saying, the prince is freaking out, the dead guy saying, don't worry, it's all going to be fine, look, I'm a magician. I know what I'm doing, you know, just trust me on this. Basically pushes him into it. The queen then turns into this sort of demon and attacks him, and that's when she then gets decapitated.
Sorry, I said we weren't going to give spoilers, and then we kind of...
we've still got...
I want to talk about the decapitations.
Basically. Yes.
Now, because that is subject matter or specific action happening that could be treading quite a dangerous line in a what is, after all, let's not forget, a comic for children.
Right.
But it's absolutely fine, I think, and it comes across absolutely fine. And why do you think that is? But I guess what I'm asking is, I don't feel I could draw that stuff in a comic and have it remotely be okay in the Phoenix. It's a tricky...
Well, okay.
It's a tricky balancing act.
There is. There's two parts to this, I think. First of all, there was a lot more blood originally, which our very wise editor made me paint out. I think that was just... It was cartoony and it wasn't gross, but I think that does help keep it on one side of the kind of censorship line, I guess. If people are going to get upset about it, they'll look for something to get upset about. That's a way of drawing it back. But I think the key thing for me is always what are these stories really about? What's going on underneath the surface, right? It's about it's about the relationships between men and women. It's about the way that among lots of other things, but there's stuff to do with the men's fear of women, which I think is often the underlying cause for a lot of violence against women.
Sure.
And I know there's a lot of the sort of zero tolerance stuff. I think is absolutely essential and important. But I also think perhaps we could give more thought to how can we find what's going on underneath? Because if we really want to stop this stuff, that has to be addressed as well. Not justifying, but thinking about where is it coming from. And a lot of the time it's coming from being a little boy, feeling powerless, growing up, feeling powerless, and then trying to assert that physically. So in terms of, there's that kind of stuff. There's also stuff to do with sex, fear of sex and so on, which again, it would be inappropriate for a children's comic if you go into a lot of detail, obviously. But kids are still aware of these dynamics. They still have to wrestle with these dynamics and, these sort of imbalances in power and how you find a way to address them. And they're symbolized in fairy tales often in fairly brutal ways. Or just in very blunt ways. I think if you treat it as a metaphor rather than as an actual, this is a thing that you should do, which obviously it's not. It's always working on a metaphoric level. So if you think about it in that sense, I think it that comes across. People respond to it in that way.
Yeah. Do you think, in terms of sort of content, we've talked before, I've always been impressed by some of the stuff you managed to get away with, I would put it as, in Corpse Talk, or... You get to include, nudity and people's intestines being pulled out through their arseholes and whatever it may be, because you have this happened, this is historic fact.
Yeah, I think they're probably going to dial back the intestines stuff as well a little bit. I think there's...
But do you think that the fact this is like these are old stories, they have... Do you think that gives you some degree of the same sort of cover or justification?
Yes, I think honestly, I think it does. I think the fact that it's an existing story and you can say, "Look, it's already there," that doesn't mean that I could get away with any story. I mean, there are some fucking brutal fairy tales out there.
Oh, God, absolutely! Yeah,
far beyond the stuff that I've put in any of these ones so far. And
but I guess if it again, it's the benefit of going to source material like that, because if you were to just come up with a story yourself, it has, as you say, weirdly so much more time-consuming, and so much more sort of groundwork has to go into it. And also, if you were to, pitch, here's a story I wrote, it's about this dude who chops off a woman's head and then throws her in a fire, you might have a tougher time pitching that, I guess.
I think it certainly makes all of those things easier, and it gives you a kind of cover to work behind. But I still think the primary thing is the fact
that... But the reason for that is because...
These are real things that real children have to deal with
in
their real lives, albeit in a... It's handled in a metaphoric way, But it's the sort of stuff that, you know, Roald Dahl is dealing with. It's the sort of stuff that Morris Sendak is dealing with. There's a wonderful... Did you ever see this? There's a wonderful comic interview that Art Spiegelman did with Morris Sendak. And then they went for a walk and they were chatting. And then... I think I have it on my blog, actually, somewhere buried in the archives. I had a link to it or something. They go for a walk and a chat, and the Spiegelman's drawn this up after the fact. And talking about doing children's books, and Morrison that gets all worked up about it, because people say to him, oh, you know, children, oh, it's so nice, it's so lovely, and being a child's so wonderful. He's like, no, it's fucking not! Being a child is awful, it's psychopaths vomiting in your mouth! this is his metaphor for childhood. And I think that this is the difference between... It doesn't always have to be so graphic, or so violent, or so angry... But I think this is the difference between really meaningful stories that children cherish and stuff that they'll read, I guess, and then move on. Has it got real stuff in it? It doesn't have to always be the difficult, awful stuff. But there are difficult, awful things that kids have to deal with, and I don't just mean, you know, traumatized kids. Kids with perfectly normal childhood still have to wrestle with awful stuff, because yeah, that's absolutely the nature of being a person, you know?
Yeah.
And it's trying to find a way to put these in a story context, a metaphoric context, that if you just put it here as a kid going through awful stuff, it's too much to deal with. Whereas if you have it in a story, it becomes a sort of a handle that you can use for your own life, or a model that you can use for your own life.
Absolutely.
And having lots and lots of different ones means you've got lots and lots of different things you can draw on at different parts of your life, or different kids can draw on for themselves, and that's really what folk tales are. You know, so in order to make something that's about that, that's why I think so many people go back to that stuff, either for, you know, these sort of fairy tale compendiums, or stories which are loosely based on or have the same sort of structure to them, because really it's the structure of the mind, it's the structure of the soul.
Absolutely.
In story form.
And what folktales have is they are extremely well worked out stories for dealing with stuff, because they are by their very nature sort of the thousandth draft, if you like.
Right,
you know,
they are
a story that has been worked out and honed and has taken on sort of its perfect form almost. By the time you hear it,
whereas
if I'm trying to make up something out of blue, that is more dependent on my skills as a writer.
Well, yes, and that is. I think there's still the craft of turning that into the story you're going to tell, and a lot of
these
stories
that could have been interpreted wrongly.
No. I mean, I think it's. That is another part of my thinking when I was coming up with this. When I say it's going to be quicker to go to that source material to get stuff out, part of that is because I'm still developing my craft as a writer. But I'm at the point where I feel like I can do them justice and pull out some of those things, I hope, those underlying things. But also it has my stamp, it has my storytelling style is developed enough that it's not just a straight.
Yeah, well, I think that's,
you know,
absolutely true, and I think that's sort of part of what makes sort of the scarier elements or the more emotionally troubling elements in these stories. What makes it feel fine and feel okay and sort of feel safe is that it's your voice is telling this story so strongly. If you see what I mean. For example, in Strong Wind and Little Scabs, the mean older sisters, they really are very mean. They are quite... It's quite awful what they do to that girl.
I have to say, it didn't really strike me how bad it was until I was actually drawing it, and then I was like, oh my god, I said I'll do it, so I've got to do it now.
But what I really loved, and that was the first episode of these appeared, and that what I really loved about that was at the cruelest moment, as they're just being unthinkably horrible to this girl, your narration sort of breaks character almost and just starts talking to the reader directly in what's very sort of clearly, you know, your voice, or feels like a very sort of honest, authentic voice. sort of discussing why would they be such assholes? What is wrong with these people? And you try to then explain it, and it's exactly as one would try to explain something horrible that had happened at school that day to a kid, if you were a teacher or a parent. You know, it was really just sort of beautifully honest, simple, non-patronizing way of trying to explain why people are such assholes, why people are such monstrous assholes. And I think because you have that, you've really honed that voice, or I don't know if it's doing the sort of couple of years of corpse talk now, but it really...
It might be, actually, because that's always a... but that's very often, that's a big part of my goal with corpse talk as well, because so many people from history are such monstrous assholes. And that big part of why, I think, why that strip works is, again, it's the same thing, because kids want to know how life works, how history works, you know, how... why people do the things they do, and some of them are awful things, you know, and that's what we're always I've been wrestling with in my whole life, I think. So it's that concern, I guess, you know, not necessarily having the answers, but kind of wrestling with the answers.
Mm. Yeah, and absolutely. As I say, I think that, works marvellously well. And I think as well, what these strips have and the way you tell them is, a admirable lack of ironic distance, I guess.
Mm.
Like, you say that sort of they're lapsing into modern speak and, you know, talking ridiculously and stuff. But it's actually, I feel like they read sort of as fairly sort of sincere tellings of these stories. They don't have the sort of nod and a wink, you know, jokiness that sort of modern retellings of these sorts of things often can, in an attempt to try and make it appeal to kids these days, whatever that means, or... they actually come across as really quite, really quite sincere and sort of heartfelt.
Well, thanks. Again, yes. I mean, it's nice to hear, because that's a big part of what I'm aiming for, and I never know has it quite worked. But I think the modern slang wouldn't work if it wasn't for that underlying. I think it has to do with our. I'm trying to find a way to phrase it, but what pisses me off in some writing for children, I don't have any in mind at the moment, obviously I'm not going to give examples, but you see it on TV sometimes, I guess, you see it in comics as well sometimes, that distance, and I think it's supposed to be, oh hey, this is going to be cool for kids, but it's really somebody who has no concept of what it's like to be a kid, because they've kind of shut it out, because that's what we all do when we grow up, because being a kid is dreadful. It is impossibly hard.
Unutterably horrible.
It's not all horrible, but the horribleness is like very raw, spend, and it's very
particularly when they're very young,
real.
But still up to quite an old age, they spend a lot of time crying.
Yeah.
Because it's horrible, and that's the only way you can express how bad things are.
And a lot of that, not all of it, but a lot of it has to do with the lack of power in your life. You're this little person that just gets pushed around and told what to do all the time.
Lack of power and just a lack of comprehension.
Lack of ability
to understand why these things are happening.
Yes, and lack of what we would, as adults, might call perspective.
Yes.
Oh, it's not really that a big deal, but as a kid it's an enormously big deal, and you don't know that it's not a big deal. Do you? It feels like life or death, and you experience it in those kind of raw terms, and as you get older, you get more power, you get more, so you tend to shut all that stuff out, oh, that doesn't apply to me anymore. Two, you then tend to act out on other people who are smaller and less powerful than you are. And I think that distance is a way of keeping those experiences at a distance. Whereas the only way to really write for children is to get back into it in some way and not keep it at a distance, but allow it back in. And I've been trying for a long time to get the strength to do that, because it's very, very hard to do.
Yeah, absolutely.
And again, I think having the source material there also makes that slightly an easier step, because it's not just my raw, unprocessed trauma dealing with.
It's humanity's raw.
Exactly. It's already there, and it's just finding that personal resonance that will make it that sort of meaningful communication, I guess.
Yes. Yeah. No. Absolutely. The one other thing, because it is comics, I suppose, we should attempt to talk about, you know, pictures a bit.
Sure.
Pictures and drawing and stuff.
Yeah.
The style in which these are drawn is, again, I can sort of, looking at these, I can see what you mean about sort of waiting until you felt you could do them justice, or waiting until you felt your voice was strong enough, or had become strongly developed enough as your own style, if this is making sense.
Yeah, they
do very much sort of read as they're sort of post corpse talk work, if you see what I mean, of yours. And they've got you've worked out how you're going to sort of treat this stuff. You've worked out the approach you're going to use, and it works so beautifully, and it's so sort of so clearly developed in style and voice.
It was interesting actually, because I was trying very hard. I wanted to make them distinct from corpse talk and distinct from other things that I might be doing, and I found that I wasn't able to direct. But I was originally thinking about doing a much simpler, much more cartoony kind of style, I guess.
Okay.
And I guess for people that haven't seen them, they're very cartoony. They're quite kind of clean line style, I guess. But
it's clean lines and flat colours, and
but so they're,
you stick to a nine panel grid, is it? On
yes,
sort of?
Yes. Yeah. No, 12, no, 12 panels. 12, 12 panels. So 3x4. I find the grid works just so solid. It works so well for just...
It's just gorgeous, yeah.
And for storytelling, and for just, you know, ease of storytelling and all that kind of stuff, it just makes life easier. But then the backgrounds are a bit richer. There's a bit more detail and, you know, time and care goes into the backgrounds. So
can I just say, as an aside, oh my god, the waves just... The way you use that style to draw the scene is stunning.
There's a little bit of, with each one I'm trying, I mean, obviously there's a commonality in the way that I'm drawing, because all my drawings kind of look like I drew them, but also I'm trying to get something of a different approach to each one, so looking at artists that are appropriate for that story. So for the first one, for Little Scabs, it's set in the Canadian Northeast. So I was looking at this guy called Tom Thompson, who is a Canadian painter, wilderness painter. And I saw my wife's Canadian, we went to see his exhibition at the Museum of Canada, or Gallery of Canada, or whatever it is. And I just walked in, there's this room filled with these little boards. What he did was he went walking off into the wilderness with this pack that he'd made that would have like 20 wooden boards in it. And he would go and do painting sketches of like different lighting effects in wilderness,
right?
Whatever,
yeah,
bring
yeah.
it back. And so there's this room that's just surrounded by these little things, and I just walked in and burst into tears. It's just the most spiritually resonant images. They're just singing with this sort of love of nature and the universe and all this kind of stuff. So I was looking at him and those colours particularly to try and get that.
The colours, sort of, the colours is something I wanted to ask you specifically about on Strong and Little Scabs. And it's really interesting to hear about where that came from, because they're extraordinary. It's good. You just sort of describe what. Did that come from Thompson then? Or
Yeah. Him? Definitely inspired by him. I don't know that I was actually picking colours from his paintings, although I will do that sometimes to get a basis for things.
Yeah.
But the other thing is also, I'm actually, I'm very fortunate to have an exceptionally talented, I'd say that she's not in the room, exceptionally talented, colorist and, general comics assistant in the form of my wife, who is, who's been helping out with this stuff. So what we did for both of these was that she'll do like a first pass on the colors. And increasingly, I'm finding her first pass needs less and less of my input on it. So we're going to get to the point where it'll have to be colours by Lisa Murphy. But
I was going to say, you know, it will be a substantial hand in this. The colour choices, just in the skies and the backgrounds, and the sense that it gives to the story of this sort of unreality, but the beauty of nature.
Yeah,
it's an amazing combination.
Yeah,
really stands out, stands out from other comics within, you know, the comic, and it sort of stands out from. I'm very bad at talking about art, as you know, because I don't understand it. Color specifically, but
yeah,
are you trying to achieve there?
A big part of it was looking at this guy Thompson and thinking about the way that he uses colors to communicate different times of day and the sort of glowing, vibrating light of the environment at different times of day. So that was a big part of it, and those weird skies and so on. Also, the coloured lines. This is the first one I've done coloured lines on.
Yeah, substantially. I noticed it in the background.
And that was also gives some of that feeling. And he does that a lot. He uses there's a kind of underpainting and then paints over the top, but he leaves gaps which then become these sort of almost like outlines of things. And then also, again, having my wife do the first pass of colours, I would get weird colour combinations that I would never have thought of.
Right.
And then I would come in and tweak it and say, well, no, I'm not quite happy with that. But at least it started me in a different direction that, you know, has broken out of my usual thinking.
Not to compare Lisa to a Photoshop plugin at all. But do you ever get that when, because you use Bpelt.
Right.
Flatting plugin for Photoshop. And sometimes when it multi-fills all your colours in.
Mm.
Sometimes you go, oh wow, look at that, that's crazy. And it will sort of, start you off in a direction it would never have occurred to you.
I think anything like that, any sort of functional, I don't know what you call it, an obstacle or a barrier, or just putting something in place that forces you out of your comfort zone and forces you to look at things in a different way.
It's just throwing an element of, not randomness, but an element of not you.
Exactly. An external something that you then have to wrestle with and, you know, come to something that you wouldn't have. It wouldn't be just your normal default starting position, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'm going to have to check out Tom Thompson.
He's really, really exceptional. Very worth looking at.
I'm going to have to travel to Canada to do this.
I'm sure you can find his stuff on. Just Google Tom Thompson and you'll see, you know, a bunch of his stuff. But it is all this stuff is not quite the same as seeing it in person. I doubt we have any here. I think he's a bit of a Canadian celebrity.
In the latest, what is as I speak the latest issue of the Phoenix, there it has the sort of juxtaposition literally there in the comic of you have your strip Dr. Smarty Pants,
mm-hmm.
and then on the next page you have the Grateful Dead guy, the conclusion of that,
mm.
and the color approach is completely different, obviously, and
I think the Dr. Smarty Pants is one that I actually did a little while ago, and I think the
I wasn't going to bring that up.
That's okay. But the
but I think if you know that, it shows the development really, really clearly. You've gone really embraced sort of flat colours and possibility that gives you.
I think that was a bit. That's very important for me. I think the not that there's no place for painted stuff, but I think I was certainly using it as a crutch to get away from having to make strong decisions about colour and about shape, painting a vague thing and I'll fix that later, you know, whereas I think, definitely I would say the colour almost more than anything else, I think, is the you can see in those what my kind of default standard, easy to do kind of colour approach would be,
right.
Which I'm trying to get away from and trying to really strengthen.
The second strip, the Grateful Dead guy, is much more sort of, you know, muted, earth tonesy.
Mm.
It feels more sort of a piece, I guess, with Corpse Talk.
Yeah. Well, that one is, there's a guy called Billy Bin, I think his name is, who's a Russian illustrator, folktale illustrator primarily, who is amazing. So I was looking at him a lot for the colour palette, for the costume design, and also things like those waves. He has just an amazing illustration of waves, and I forget what it is. There's somebody being tossed in the waves or something. So looking at the way that he kind of was using those things and trying to get a bit of that Russian folktale feel while still making it my style and appropriate, you know, fitting with the other stuff and the other,
sure, sure.
The content of the story. So, yeah.
So, that's two down. So, you say you're working on a third strip.
There's a third one I'm working on now, which is, I can give you just the, again, the intro to it. It's called The Gifts of Wally Dad. And this is a story from Punjab.
Okay, cool.
And the idea is this guy, Wally Dad, is this wonderfully virtuous, poor guy. He's a grass cutter, which means he cuts grass and sells it as animal feed to farmers. And he lives such a pure and virtuous life that he doesn't even need the meager amount of money that this pays. So he puts his extra, he gets an extra penny a day or whatever it is, and he puts it in a jar in the back of his hut. So one day he decides to break open the jar and see what he's got, and he's got this enormous big pile of money. And so he goes, what am I going to do with this? I don't want money, I don't need anything, everything that I want is right here. So he conceives this idea to find out who the most virtuous lady in the world is, and he's going to give her a gift. So he spends all the money on this golden bracelet and gets his friend, who's a travelling merchant, to take it to this princess, who's supposedly the most virtuous lady in the world, gives her this gift. Princess is like, who the hell's this guy? Never heard of him. It's a nice gift, though. I guess we should send him something in return. So she sends him a slightly larger gift in return. So he's like, what am I going to do now? I didn't mean to get a gift back. You can see where this is going, right? He then finds this other guy, there's a prince who is a equally virtuous prince, so he sends the gift off to this guy in the hopes that that will get rid of it, and the prince sends it back to him again, even bigger. So this continues with basically how is he going to get out of this snafu, because every time he sends a gift he gets a bigger one back, and he's just trying to get rid of the poor guy. So it gets worse and worse and worse, and it reaches a dreadful head of stress. He ends up, he's actually thinking about killing himself just to get out of this, because it's this nightmare situation. Which I guess that's the dark bit in this one. And that one I was pleased because
I was going to say it sounded quite comedic and frothy.
It is. It's a much, it's a much lighter, I think it is lighter than both the ones we've done so far.
I mean, there's a guy contemplating suicide.
I had to get some of that. And that one was interesting, actually. I went, again, going back and finding the original source material. There was a lot of stuff in there that wasn't in some of the retellings that I'd seen. So anyway, that's the kind of... it's
not darker stuff, or just odder stuff?
Both.
Details?
Yeah, all three. Details, weird bits. I mean, the big challenge for this one was that the original version is very much, you know, he's going to end up rich and happy and successful. Which just seemed like a bit of a letdown, really, because that's not what the guy was all about. So it was finding a way of
being true to
the story, but also a modern tweak that would just make him sort of come alive, I guess. And I had read modern versions of it that had that sort of modern tweak, but I wasn't quite happy with those ones, so it's finding my own tweak on it, which obviously I can't go into because that's the ending. But
so I'm
maybe a third of the way through the inking of that one. Now, the nice thing about these is that they're not strictly on a schedule, they've already scheduled it. my goal originally was that I would do these just, you know, as and when I've got time to put one together, and then once they had it in the bag finished, then they could schedule it. They're actually scheduling them while they're still in progress, but that's quite good as well, because then I've got the stories locked down and all that kind of stuff, and I know I've got a goal, you know, to make sure that I get it done. So
they're just too good, Adam. I can see there being a desire to get more of these, to schedule these in as
well. It's just fitting it all in, you know, it's fitting in with Corpse Talk, and there's got to be something, because as you know, comics, even doing quite a lot of comics, doesn't really pay the bills, so there's always got to be a little something else in there that you know, just keeps the heating on.
Yes.
So that's just the challenge. If there was none of that stuff, I would just But even then, I mean, I would do this full time, all the time, except, you know, I've got to keep Corkstock going, because that's a wonderful strip as well. I love doing
Absolutely,
that one.
Yeah,
and there's others,
I love seeing,
you know, it's just,
artists start to diversify.
Yeah, yeah.
But I also, you know, much as I love these, I was like, this doesn't mean I'm just going to stop doing Corkstock. And so
well,
when Jamie
yeah.
started having Lushkin appear in the comic, I was like, yeah, but he's going to keep
going.
He's
going to keep it going, right? Yeah, yeah, yeah. And he had that one where Bunny goes off for a walk, and then there's a little, like, maybe this is going to be a break. I was like, no, you can't do that.
Yeah, I know.
And then it was in there next week, so I think we're okay, actually. It's just,
I know, he was messing with me. He was trying to, like, convince me that it was actually, that was it. He can foot the bill for my son's therapy, if that's the case.
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying. But you, so you will be still doing Corpse Talk?
Oh, yeah,
that,
yeah,
that's
yeah,
still
yeah.
a regular,
yes,
ongoing...
Yes, definitely.
Very good. Because you're some way from running out of dead people. Right?
There's no shortage, you know. You know. Even ignoring all the people that keep dying, there's just so many people from history, and there's so many requests. I mean, I thought eventually I'm going to
get
requests are going to start drying up, and I have gotten a few now where people obviously didn't, you know, people have requested somebody from the, you know, the early days of the Phoenix, because
I mean, that was coming up on, well, you haven't been in every issue, but you must be not far from
it's got to be close to it. But still, I'm keeping getting interesting, you know, requests that people I never heard of, or people I hadn't thought of, and all this kind of stuff, so I think it can run for quite a while, so long as they're still, you know, kids are still enjoying it, I'll keep doing
it. You've got one strip that has the entire wealth of human history and, well, the entire dead mass of humanity to draw on Fridays, and then you now have you're supplementing it with a strip that draws on the entire cultural traditions of humanity. That's just genius. It's... You will never run out of ideas, right? That's remarkable. Yeah. I'm quite jealous of just what great ideas for strips these are.
Yeah, you should have thought of it first.
So I've been trying not to swear too much. Some of our young readers might be interested in, but I'm just really, really angry about this, Adam.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Sorry about that.
So, but you will hopefully be doing these. Do you think you'll be doing this on a sort of semi-ongoing basis?
Oh, yes, or? Yes, certainly, yeah. Certainly. As I said, the one I'm doing now is the third one that I've got scripted. So I scripted up three in a batch, and then we kind of worked through them, you know, the editorial process, and then drew them up one at a time.
We sort of touched on this earlier, but did you, without, you know, going into details being indiscreet, was there much sort of editorial push back on some of the more more beheading-y?
No, not really at all. I mean, I think the Phoenix guys are really, they're really good at this stuff. They're really intuitive about what's, first of all, it's got to be for kids first and foremost. Mm. What's going to be appealing, what's going to resonate with kids. But also, it's got to be acceptable to parents. What's going to be crossing the line? Like I said, while I was drawing up the Grateful Dead guy, they came back to me and said, you know what, we think actually having even cartoony blood in the comics, we're just going to dial that back now. They have had some, I've done it in the past, but I think they had one strip, another strip, not mine actually, which had a lot of blood in it, and it made them think, you know what, really, across the board, we should just make this a rule.
Someone crossed the line and it wasn't you.
Incredible. what they were saying, and I thought this was actually very good thinking, is that if we're careful with this particular aspect, then we have more leeway to be more transgressive, I guess.
Yeah,
in the things where it really counts. In
core
story things, which are like that stuff I've been ranting about, why it's so important that kids have access to these kind of stories and, you know, these kind of metaphors to live with, that aren't sugar-coated, but are still, I mean, we do have quite young kids reading it, so it's also got to be sensitive to that as well, that you can go far enough and you're actually traumatizing kids rather than helping them deal with trauma, which is not the goal. So it's...
No, no. It's maybe traumatize them a little bit, you know, just for kicks.
Well, you know, it's walking that line, I guess. And I think a lot of the time the editorial stuff is much more to do with, particularly because it's so tight, space is so tight, how do we make sure that the story really is coming across the clearest and the most impactful way possible, and are there ways to tweak things so that they... And there's been a couple of really good bits that Tom, particularly, I'm working most closely with Tom on this.
Okay, cool.
That he's come back with, you know, just little tweaks. Just this panel, can he say this, or, you know, could you just squeeze this in somewhere?
But just for sort of storytelling or clarity.
Exactly. That actually does just lift the whole thing up and makes the other bits that much clearer, just because it's got that bit of kind of grounding early on.
Yeah.
So mostly I would say the editing process has been that sort of stuff.
Yeah, no, it's, telling stories in very short space is endlessly challenging, really.
Yeah, it certainly is. But it's good. I like that exercise. You feel like you've whittled it down to the real core essence, and every bit of, like, funny gag, or every little bit of just interesting background detail, or, oh, let's look at time passing here, or whatever. You know, it has to be in there because it's serving some essential story purpose.
Yeah, and any panel, any line you draw, it has to be serving at least three different purposes.
Right, exactly.
I won't mention any names, but I did read a fairly lengthy graphic novel the other day, ostensibly for younger readers, and it just felt so flabby to me. I just couldn't believe how lazy it felt. Vast stretches that didn't seem to be serving any point other than I feel like drawing this cool stuff, you know? Anyway, not to be negative on other artists, because there are many different approaches to storytelling.
Well, everybody's doing their best, you know?
Yes.
With what they've indeed. Got, and that's the best I can hope for, so. You
know. Indeed. But I think things like the if no blood is a blanket rule, then I think things like that are maybe, yes, a really good idea, because that you don't want to be wasting time getting called out on the things that don't matter, and giving people who you don't want to be giving people an excuse not to listen to what you have to say. If you see what I mean.
Right. You don't exactly, want exactly.
Those easy markers
right,
to pick
right,
on.
Right. And you want to be ready if people are going to pick holes in things that you can come back and say why you think this is important. You know, and I hope that I'd be able to do that on any of these, and I hope that the editorial team on the Phoenix would have the same. And I think that's true. So
absolutely. Cool. Well, I think I've come to the end of my list of questions I wanted to ask you.
I've covered about everything we can possibly think of.
We've talked about 12 pages of comics we're talking about here.
Fourteen at the moment. Yep.
We've talked about 14 pages of comics in quite a lot of detail, I guess. I do have one last question, which is from Logan, my son. I told him I was talking to you and asked if he had any questions, and he just wanted to know who your favourite corpse was.
Ooh. Well, that's a good question.
Which I thought was a good question.
Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of obvious. He could have worked a little harder there, but he didn't.
There's a few. Possibly... Well, there's two ways of answering that. I mean, I would say possibly somebody like Hokusai, who's such an inspiration, you know, such a powerful inspiration for me in my artistic development and my life and everything, and to fictitiously be able to speak to him, even though I was putting words in his mouth, it was also things that he actually said and things he actually did. So something like that was really special to me. But
I
then...
imagine so.
I have to say that what I'm realizing recently, I think the best one that's been published was actually Dracula, who's the most horrendous, vile
Logan's gonna
person
love that
imaginable.
That's his favorite strip of all time, yeah.
I think that is the best one, except for I've just finished doing Ramesses II, who is, he's not quite as vile, but he is also a monstrous asshole. And there's something about the guys that are just total dicks that makes for a really entertaining, because it means I can argue with them and they can try and put
you can argue, and also just the it's got to be a challenge, and I'd imagine a rewarding challenge, of expressing and attempting to get to the roots of their monstrous assholery in ways that seven-year-olds can understand.
Exactly. I think that
not
that
being
really,
troubled by nightmares about forever.
Yeah. So that really kind of lifts it, I think. So, yeah, certainly the ones that are in the comic, Dracula's, it just worked so well, and it was so hard. That was by far the hardest one I've ever had to do, because he's so, so awful. He's so much more awful than... And he was the first one where I had to say, you know what, there is stuff you can't do it for kids, you can't.
Yeah,
you have to dial
no.
it back. And I really felt like I was boulderizing myself and beating myself up for ages. But it worked really, really well. And so I think that's
really,
something
really
to bear in mind, that kind of, there's that kind of friction, I think,
to
that
this
just brings
Logan
up.
Will run around the house saying, do you know what my favorite food is? And I'm like, what is it? And you go, blood, bread, dipped in the blood of my victims.
Fantastic.
That's the funniest thing he's ever read.
That's a wonderful thing to hear. Thank you. Thank you.
Not at all. Anyone listening to this can, of course, find your work in The Phoenix pretty much every week,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah, pretty much, yeah.
I wondered if you wanted to get a quick plug-in at the end for your new comic, which I'm very excited to have seen.
Well,
you're going to be launching a new comic at Thought Bubble.
This year, November, what is it, 23rd and 24th in Leeds?
It's 23rd, it's Doctor Who Day.
Yep.
Me.
Oh, nice. and yes, speaking of things which are inappropriate for children, this one is actually inappropriate for children. This
just completely.
Completely inappropriate. And as I've said before, probably inappropriate for many adults as well. The book is called Fever Dreams. And it's a collection of 14 short stories, which range from, some are actually very nice. Some of them are quite heartwarming and bittersweet and sad. But I was surprised. These were done over the period of in the last 2 or 3 years. These are little.
What are we talking about? Are they sort of from an autobiographical
place? None of them are.
That wasn't meant to be a deep sort of metaphysical
question. Yeah,
all stories are.
Yes, exactly. And I think these ones, it's certainly the autobiographical, emotional stuff is fairly apparent, but they're not actually autobiography. They're not directly about me in any way. But they're experimental, I guess. I had for a long time, and it sort of dried up when I quit to do comics full time. It was harder to do spare time comics, which I'm now getting back into. But
good on you, man. I can't do that.
Yeah, well, it's difficult. But when I say I'm getting back into it, I mean I've kind of set the intention more than anything else. But when I was still working a day job, I would get up an hour early and I did an hour of completely blank page. I don't know what I'm going to do. Just sit and start drawing and see what comes out kind of comics.
Oh, fantastic.
And so they basically came out of that. Some of them are literally one page and they were done in that hour and then they just kind of worked out. And some of them turned into something a bit bigger and I sort of spent a bit more time on them and sort of fleshed out a bit. The longest one is, I think, maybe 8 pages. So it's that sort of...
You got up 8 hours early that day.
No, I did it over the course. I'd start, I had that initial inspiration was the first hour, and then I took time over a week or two, in lunch breaks and stuff, to sort of flesh it out.
So this is all stuff dating back from the having a real...
A lot of it does.
Period.
There's one or two that are more recent. I just did the... I should also probably plug this. The Arvon Foundation is this charitable foundation that does writing, residential writing workshops on this amazing country farmhouse.
You went on the course, didn't you?
Yes,
this
was run by Dan Berry and Carrie Fransman, where the tutors, and it was just
so amazing.
The best thing ever. If I could have said what was going to be on the course and hired who was going to do it and said where it was going to be, it couldn't possibly be better than what it was. I couldn't recommend this enough. These people normally do creative writing stuff. They're starting to get into doing comics. They call it text and image so that, snooty writing types won't turn their nose up. Comics. Yeah, exactly. And there were a few people on the course that kind of struggled with that word. And you can understand that, where people are coming from different places. That's
absolutely.
Fine.
Absolutely.
But it was comics and it was just everything you could have wanted from... So I learned so much, but also the inspiration. Part of that was that we had kind of workshops and lecture-y kind of stuff in the mornings. Then we had free time in the afternoons to work on and complete a 4-page story by the end of the week. So the final story in this book is that story that was completed on that course. So there is at least one thing that's more recent, and also the a few of the things in there have been on my website, but there's a lot of stuff that's never been seen before because it's been languishing in a sketchbook. A big thing for me was going on that course and just chatting with the other students, and people had looked through my sketchbook and they liked it. They said nice things about it, and have you ever collected this as a book? Because you should. And I hadn't, because I thought, oh, nobody will be interested. You know, the usual kind of crap. And actually, some of this stuff's quite good. Why not put it together? Why not put it out there? So a big, big part of it was just that encouragement to do that. And,
oh, brilliant, yeah.
You know, make it into something and put it out there. And I had originally thought I was going to do a new thing for Thought Bubble, and that didn't happen. So then I was like, well, there's all this material that's actually...
I cannot fault your ambition.
Actually really quite good. So, you know, so that's kind of where it came from. And when I started putting it together and whittling it down to the really, really good stuff, I was surprised by how thematically consistent it is. Basically, a lot of it's about sex. A lot of it's about really upsetting sexual obsession kind of stuff. But then
you know what,
also,
I think if I forced myself to get out of bed an hour early and just draw whatever was going on in my head,
right.
I can see how that would happen.
Well, that's part of it. A lot of stuff about sex, a lot of stuff about wrestling with the nature of God, the nature of being alive, and...
Less of that for me at 6 o'clock.
No, I find it's all kind of much of a muchness, but it's and it's all there, and I was just very pleased, like, going back to that stuff and seeing that actually these things that I've been trying for so long to put them into some sort of physical form that can be shared with people, and they're actually there. It's actually worked better than, you know, when you're doing it, you think this is the most awful thing ever, and I'm the most awful person
ever.
And then you
making comics is horrible.
Yeah, and then you put it away and you come back to it and say, not all of it, obviously, but you just gloss over the crap. You just don't see it. You just go flick, oh, that one's kind of good. Flick, oh, that one's kind of good. You know, so that's been the kind of the editing process has been a part of the whole putting it together as well for this one. Sort of mining that material for things that were actually really exciting and worth sharing. So.
Sure.
So that's it. It's called Fever Dreams. It's going to be launched at Thought Bubble. I have a bunch of copies there, and I've got some amazing looking postcards. I'm really, really pleased with the way that everything's come back, and posters and things as well. And then when I get back from Thought Bubble, I'll be putting it all up on my website, which is adammurphy.com, which will, I'm quite sure this is going to work. It will have a working shop, and people will be able to purchase it there if they're not able to get to Thought Bubble in person.
Marvellous. Well, I'm looking forward to it hugely.
Thank you very much.
It sounds fascinating. And, I can't wait to read it, really.
Cool.
Okay, well, thank you very much for... thank you very much, Adam, for letting me interview you.
My pleasure, Neil. Thank you.
Cool. Okay, well, thanks very much, Adam Murphy. I guess I'll stop recording at this point.
All right, nice one.